I want to bring in Denis Rancourt, a PhD, full professor of physics from University of Ottawa. He put out a brilliant article recently that really went into thorough, Masks Don't Work is the title, a review of science relevant to COVID-19 social policy. He goes through all of the studies and lays it out. So let me just bring on Denis, because you have done a much thorough dive on this. Overall, why did you write an article? We live in a time where people and governments, whether it's Canada, America, France, you name it, we are terrified of this disease. Masks is being touted as the way that we can really slow the spread. So what inspired you to go against that sort of river of understanding coming from our leading health departments and decide to write an article that even challenges the notion that maybe masks don't work?
Dal, it's not a river of understanding. It's a river of talk. It's a river of posturing. It's a river of policy statements and things like that. There's no understanding. I don't see any understanding in what these politicians say. If you look at the literature, you have to look at randomized controlled trials, but with a verified outcomes where you've actually measured whether the person was infected or not. Not, you know, ask them if a week ago they had the sniffles and things like that. You have to measure it. If you select only those reliable trials done in a proper scientific way to avoid bias, because that's the whole idea of this kind of lab design, is to avoid bias in the observation. If you look at those, and there have been dozens of them, or at least, you know, many of them over the last decade, none of them show a statistically significant advantage to wearing a mask compared to not wearing a mask. That's the scientific result. And what that means is, if there was any kind of a significant advantage in terms of limiting your risk to being infected by a viral respiratory disease using a mask, it would have shown up in one of these very reliable trials that was done. And there have been many, and I reviewed them all. And there have been one or two that have come out since, and they also agree in the same direction. So this took us, I am a researcher with the Ontario Civil Liberties Association, and this caused us to write to the World Health Organization, the Director General, and say, what the heck are you doing? Why are you now recommending masks? You know, forever you have been not recommending masks for use in the general public because you've admitted that there's dangers associated with that. The masks collect and gather all kinds of pathogen-laden materials near your face and eyes and nose and everything, and then you touch the mask and you touch the rest of your body. So it was thought that there was danger associated with that concentration of pathogens, and that's why the main world health organizations did not recommend mask use in a general population, which is not a controlled clinical environment where clinicians, you know, properly remove their masks, immediately wash their hands, and dispose of them in the proper way. To just throw the idea of masks out in the general population and even, you know, wear whatever and so on is potentially was believed to be a dangerous thing, making matters worse. And then they abandoned that and flipped it around in the total absence of supportive evidence. They used what I call substandard science, which does not use randomized controlled trials and doesn't have verified outcomes. They looked at those articles, and there's a lot of scientists writing those kinds of articles because it's easy to write an article in a pandemic. It's easy to, you know, the idea is during a pandemic, you should be able to get your scientific results out quickly to help. Actually, the opposite is true. That's when you don't want bad science, is when everyone's terrified and you're in a pandemic. You want to have the highest quality standards for the science that you publish and for the recommendations that you make, the policy recommendations that you make. So instead, they've gone the other way. And it has resulted in what I think is a very political statement by the World Health Organization, which unfortunately affects governments, in particular in Canada. So we felt it was important to complain about that and to point out the additional dangers to mask that are beyond what was said in that they even admitted. And so we made a long list of additional dangers that had not been considered yet.
Can you take me through, just because, you know, and by the way, anyone watching the show for the first time, all of the science that we talk about, we are totally transparent on the show. I'm not trying to tell you what to think. I'm trying to show you how to think, where to look. So right now, all you have to do is type ICAN, if you're watching on Facebook right now, into the comments, and we'll make sure that you get this incredible study and review, and along with all the other ones, all the pro and con reviews. You can read it and come to your own conclusions. But can you take me through those people that sort of geek out on the science? What were the main studies that you looked at that you thought really show us, you know, that masks are not an effective tool in stopping COVID-19?
Oh, well, they all the, as I said, if you use only proper studies, randomized controlled trials with verified outcomes, they all unambiguously say somewhere in the article and usually in the abstract also that there is no statistical evidence of a benefit in terms of reducing risk of getting a viral respiratory disease. They all say it. You don't have to pick one that is particularly good that says it and the others don't say it. And for example, the most recent one is the one by Xiao, 2020, this year. It's entitled Non-Pharmaceutical Measures for Pandemic Influenza in Non-Healthcare Settings, Personal Protective and Environmental Measures, and it was published in Emerging Infectious Diseases on May 5th, 2020. And they're very unambiguous. They put it this way. If you want me to read the key paragraph, I can.
Yeah,
but
go ahead, please.
Would you like me to? Okay.
Yeah.
They put
yeah.
it this way. They say, and I can explain what they mean if you need me to,
okay.
Although mechanistic studies support the potential effect of hand hygiene or face masks, evidence from 14 randomized controlled trials of these measures did not support a substantial effect on transmission of laboratory-confirmed influenza. We similarly found limited evidence on the effectiveness of improved hygiene and environmental cleaning. So here's the latest, best study in the sense that uses only these very bias-free studies that says, look, it doesn't matter if you sanitize surfaces. It doesn't matter if you're washing your hands, and masks don't work. It's basically telling you that. That's what the science tells us. That's the current science. And there's good reason for that. And the reason is that we know, and we have known for a decade now, that the main transmission route of all of these types of viral respiratory diseases is very fine aerosol particles that are supported as part of the fluid air. With those kinds of particles, they're going to get through the sides of the masks, even the tiny wrinkles you have in your skin and so on. There's no way you can prevent these aerosol particles from either entering or coming out. So masks are not going to work under these circumstances. And we know and we understand why you get this transmission in the winter. And that's because these fine aerosol particles are stabilized in the air when the absolute humidity is low. And as soon as summer comes around and there's more humidity in the air, the transmissivity drops to a factor of four or five lower. So they just go away. You don't transmit them anymore. So the centers of transmission are in the winter in mid-latitude countries. There's a narrow band where you get all these diseases behave the same way. They've been co-evolving with us, with our ancestors for 5 million years. This is happening all the time. It happens in the winter, so it's reversed in the southern hemisphere at those mid-latitudes. This is all extremely well-understood science. It's just that the people, the science policy people that you see on TV aren't aware and don't read the top science and aren't, for some reason, are not paying attention to it. But the top scientists have known this forever, well, for the last decade anyway. And so the transmissivity is understood, the mechanism is understood, and based on that, we know why masks shouldn't work. It would be surprising if they did work. And so it's not about droplets, it's not about spitballs, it's not about surfaces and fomites and all that kind of stuff. It has nothing to do with it. It's all about buildings where you have fine aerosol particles suspended in the air of the building. They can be measured, they're in high concentration. That's where the transmission occurs. So you're looking at daycare centers, hospitals, potentially places where the air is fairly closed in. That's where, and people's homes as well, traditionally. And that's where transmission occurs in the winter in mid-latitude countries.
Okay,
not
so
when you get too cold
and
not when you get too warm.
Let me then ask you a question. I don't know if you watched the whole show. I don't expect that you did, but I really posed a question about the spike, certainly, that we saw in America.
Yes.
That it begins at the end of March, and we're coming out of it now, which is totally outside of a cycle we would expect for coronavirus. As you said, here was the CDC's. We see this gigantic spike in, you know, April, May.
Yes.
And it should have happened in the fall. What are your thoughts on why this is happening there?
Well, Dal, you know, I wrote a whole paper on your theory. I heard your theory explained at the beginning there, and I think you're absolutely right. And I wrote a paper on that came out on the 2nd of June, 2020. And you've got it up on the screen there. That's right.
Okay. So, plague and a likely signature of mass homicide by government response. Okay?
Yes.
What are your thoughts?
And, well, my thoughts are, well, first of all, the graph you showed is a little different from the graph that I show because you're adopting the way of showing it that hides the truth, in a sense. And that's because all the governments are plotting it that way. But if you actually plot it in the way that epidemiologists plot it, you'll get something that looks a little bit different. I'll show you a graph of that in a second here, if I can just pull out the right one. You see, that peak that you're talking about only occurs in certain jurisdictions, in certain states, and not in others. So it only occurs in the states that did these kind of very severe emptying the hospital type procedures, but not in California or Texas and a lot of these bigger states where they didn't do that. So, but if you plot it, I don't know if it's a good idea to show you this way, but if you plot...
Go ahead.
Okay, so here's all-cause mortality as a function of time on a bi-week basis.
Okay.
And what you see is there's a winter burden of deaths every winter, and it's a hump, okay? And the important point is that this latest one here, which has that peak that you talked about, which is unnatural and has never been seen before, which is due to human intervention, I would agree with you on that. But the important point is that the area under these peaks is the total mortality, the total winter burden mortality, all causes. And that has not changed. There are not bodies in the street. It's not a killer. You see large changes when there's an earthquake that kills people in a country or something and things like that. You don't see anything like this here. You can go to Europe, United States, Canada, and so on. The winter burden, all-cause mortality, is statistically the same as it has been for the last many decades. And that is because of the nature of these diseases. Here's what it looks like over a 10 or 20 year period. Okay?
Oh, yeah.
You always get these peaks. And it's been understood since the beginning of this science that these viral and respiratory diseases put a heavy burden on people that are immune deficient, that are already in a fragile state. It causes you, when you get infected by this and these aerosols go deep into your lung and your immune system has to start fighting it, your immune system requires a lot of metabolic energy to do that, and it will shut down other functions even to get that metabolic energy. It becomes the priority thing that you have to do to survive. And so anyone who is in a fragile state is going to be put at great risk because of that infection. Okay, that's been understood. And that's why you get these winter burden deaths. And it hasn't been any different this year. And this is why I tell people, stop talking about cause of death, because that's a very tenuous and biased thing. It's very difficult to measure where you have comorbidity conditions and you have a complex situation like this. You don't try to split hairs and decide what killed the person. You look at total all-cause deaths, and what you see is that it's no different than for the last several decades, but there's that peak that you mentioned. Now, that peak is unnatural. It's nothing like this over the last many decades. Nothing like this has ever been seen before. It's unnatural because it's way too sharp. Viral infection peaks in the general population, unless you're doing something, are never that sharp.
Right.
It's way too late in the season. Okay? And it happens in synchronicity with the declaration of the pandemic everywhere at the same time.
Right.
All the European countries where it happens, the U.S., Canada, all the jurisdictions, all the specific states that did this, where it happens, it's happening at the same time. everyone went into lockstep with what the World Health Organization suggested. I think they used it as a justification for doing it. In fact, the World Health Organization recommended that they empty their hospitals, that they prepare their hospitals for something huge that was going to happen, and everybody went along with that. So, well, not everybody. The jurisdictions that did had that peak. The jurisdictions that didn't, because they used their own science, their own judgment, did not have a peak like that. In fact, yeah. I can show you California. It looks very, very here's California. Okay?
Yeah.
So that red line is where the pandemic was declared, and there is no so-called COVID peak on the other side of it. So nothing special happened in California because they didn't go all out and start putting people on
ventilators and things like
ventilators and so on, right?
So let me ask you this final question, because, you know, I think we're now, and people that watch my show, we've been presenting science. We really geek out on the science. Obviously, I haven't held you to a 30-second soundbite. We really want to understand what's going on here. But I just feel like I'm getting frustrated, because I feel like so much of the population doesn't really understand a concept of herd immunity, doesn't understand, you know, how viruses move every year they're alive. They've just never been focused on it. So it seems like they're gullible to whatever they're told in the news by the scientific body. They just assume that must be the truth. But, you know, as a scientist, and I'm meeting more and more, you know, men and women like you, how frustrating is it to see the bastardization of something you do for a living, and who's in charge of it?
Well, I think you can tell from my excitement how frustrated I am. I mean, it's frustrating on many, many levels. It's frustrating because the top officials, the government officials, the health officials, are talking nonsense, total nonsense. And even among professional scientists, there's a lot of scientists that will not say what their real conclusions are and what they really think. There's a kind of a political correctness that comes from peer review, where you have to admit that everybody's work is fine and cite it all, and then you end up with this mushy statement at the end. And you gave examples of that in some of the papers you were reading. So yeah. A scientist might be doing good work, applying good statistical methods, but then in getting through the hurdle of peer review, they end up saying that fomite's important, droplets are important, aerosols are important, everything's important. And you end up with just this mushy science. In fact, everything is not important. There is a dominant transmission mechanism. This is an infection that penetrates the lungs via aerosol particles. These are, if you as a scientist don't see that and don't admit it and feel obliged to talk about spitballs and things like that, then we're not doing science that is helpful to public policy, okay?
What
then
should
you're just
be the
murking
public
the
policy?
Waters.
In your, if you were able, if someone said, okay, Denis, what is our public policy moving forward? What do you think we should do?
Well, first of all, this was not a killer event. The winter burden mortality has not been greater than usual. There was an anomalous peak there, which needs to be investigated criminally. And through real methods of discovery of what happened and investigation, and because it is a big anomaly and it targeted some very vulnerable people, and that needs to be investigated. So if I was in charge of public policy, there'd be some serious investigating going on and outlining exactly the chronology and the circumstances of those deaths that happened very suddenly. There was an acceleration of, I would say, killing off some very vulnerable people in some centers where this was happening. So that is needed just to get to clear the air and to learn from our mistakes and to also hold people responsible for the decisions they made in the absence of science and in the absence of trying to discover what would be the best way, but instead just listening to authorities from the World Health Organization and others, okay? And I would say forget about the vaccine thing. You don't need vaccines for seasonal viral respiratory infections. Is it even a good idea to go there? I don't think so. These viruses mutate extraordinarily quickly, and they're mutating all the time. Why would you introduce vaccines into that mix when we've been living with these things for a long, long time, and our immune systems have been co-adapting to these viruses continuously for 5 million years? So why do you need to go there? I don't think you need to go there. And it's dangerous and it's reckless to go there. So I would avoid that completely. The real answer is, and if I'm the boss, is to look at the medicine, do an integrated, try to do science that is integrated science to try to understand the nature of vulnerability, immune vulnerability. Mm-hmm. Because the people that die are the ones that are immune vulnerable. What is the science of how this viral infection first attacks you, how it progresses in your body, how your immune system responds to it, what your immune system needs in order to respond to it, what are the metabolic energy fluxes that are happening? Because the death rate is way more a result of whether or not your population is immune prepared. You know, how many immune vulnerable people are there and will they be infected? That will determine the death rate way more than the particular strain of the virus, which is what I argued in my paper from reviewing the literature. So I think I would move public policy in that direction and away from these money-making vaccine schemes. That's what I would do.
Denis, it's very refreshing to hear from you. I really want to thank you for your work. I want to thank you for being brave. I know it's not necessarily lucrative science to go out and tell the truth against policymakers. But there are more and more of you stepping forward. We have been very blessed on the show to find scientists all around the world. And as you pointed out, I actually believe you're right. It isn't the river of science that you're up against. Actually, the river is those that know the truth, that are really starting to speak out. We've got to do something about this rogue group of people that I believe are destroying the world and the future for our children. They're making us afraid of boogeymen that don't exist. And it's really great to have you joining us in this fight, which I think ultimately becomes a fight for freedom. So it's great to know we have science, real science, on our side. Thank you for joining us.
It was a pleasure, Del.
If you liked that clip, then be sure to check out our live broadcast of The High Wire every Thursday morning at 11 a.m. Pacific time. You can watch it on Facebook, YouTube, iTunes, and Twitter. We'll see you there.